All right. Good morning again. For those of you who are just joining us, it is Thursday, June 30th. And we are about to hear the second of our cases scheduled for oral argument this morning. I am Sarah Wheelock, the presiding judge this morning, along with judges Lucinda Jessen and Peter Reyes. And we are holding our hearings via Zoom.gov. I'm going to address a few things before we begin in this virtual format. Oral arguments are recorded by the court, and the audio recordings of those arguments are generally available on the court website within 24 hours. I will note that our appellate rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of an oral argument unless you've received the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with specific conditions established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. With that, Marshall, will you please call the next case before us?
This is case A21-1578, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Christopher Lee Konakowitz, Appellant.
Counsel, as you probably know, you will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock and a square on your screen. It should be in the upper left-hand corner, and that will be reset for each argument. Please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument and identify the party that you represent so that our recording is clear. Please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you are not speaking. And finally, if anyone has any difficulty with the technology at any point, please let me know. We will stop and try to help resolve that because we do want to hear from everyone. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court. My name is Michelle Olson, and I represent the appellant, Christopher Konakowitz, in this matter. This is an issue of a case that has been brought more than 20 years after the alleged incidents occurred. The reasoning for this is based on statements by Deputy Jeremy Reed of the Brown County Sheriff's Office, claiming that he and the Brown County Sheriff's Office were not aware of these incidents or alleged incidents until November of 2019. Therefore, the statute of limitations would be allowed. The statute of limitations is a de novo review under Park Nicollet Clinic v. Hammond, 808 Northwest 2nd, at 831, it's a Minnesota Supreme Court 2011 case. Really, the preliminary matter here is whether or not the prosecution was allowed to proceed with these issues or these allegations due to the nature and the statute of limitations under Minnesota law. The Minnesota-
Counsel, if I could stop you there, I just want to make sure I understand your argument on appeal. Is your argument on appeal that the statute of limitations ran because of the police knowing about it in 2001?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I know the original counsel, which kind of gets to my second point of the ineffective assistance of counsel, discussed the 2008 polygraph. However, in reviewing the statements made by Deputy Reed, he testified at the contested omnibus hearing that he had been made aware of these incidents through a CHIPS file that was related to Mr. Konakowitz and his minor children. In that CHIPS file, there was a 2001 police report from Brown County Sheriff's Office in which this victim had these same claims made, and they found nothing to pursue at that point. In fact, the victim's mother stated that these incidents didn't happen, that the daughter never said that they happened, which was the victim in that case. The issue becomes Deputy Reed claimed that he kind of found out and started investigating the case based on the 2008 polygraph. However, it doesn't matter when Deputy Reed found out. Really, it's when the police department first had notice of these allegations. The fact that they chose not to pursue is their issue, not my client.
If I could stop you there. I think part of what I'd like to understand your perspective on is how specific does that notice need to be? Assuming that we would look at the 2001 report, you know, which, I mean, it's a whole other issue considering it wasn't raised below. But if we do, I mean, so they knew about, there was something about this, the appellant and this victim, and there was some sort of investigation, but does it have to be, how specific does it have to be? And where do we look for guidance on the specificity? It seems to be, to me, looking at some of the case law, it's not like notice pleading, right? There's got to be some more specific allegations, but I'm finding it hard to figure out where to draw those lines. Can you help me?
I agree with you, Your Honor. There hasn't been a major distinction in this type of situation. And I think that's because we have this statute of limitation. I think this is a pretty rare case that 20 years down the line, someone is making an allegation and bringing it up. I think you don't need to have absolutely every allegation, but there needs to be enough notice that something could be occurring in which the police should or determine whether they should further investigate. If they choose not to investigate, it is because they felt there wasn't enough evidence to bring forward or to consider. And that is an allowance under what the police do as investigations to make a determination if charges should be brought to the county attorney's office. However, the issue runs here is we would run into the problem of this situation where the child said nothing happened. There were no incidents at all, not specific incidents, just nothing happened ever. And that got put in a file in 2001 and 20 years later, well, almost 20 years later in 2019, this woman claims that things have happened and that they did. And it sparked based on significant newspaper and publicity within these cases from other instances. And that's the concern because there is no evidence now further. I apologize. I heard someone.
Yeah, sorry, that was me. So I want to ask you about this further. I do want to come back to the other question that Judge Justin hinted at, but looking at the substance here, you said victim had these same claims made, but my understanding of what had happened in 2001 and what the police investigated was actually a different victim. They realized that the victim here, second victim, CR, was with the first victim in the bathroom. There's the bathroom incident, but CR testified and CR's mother testified that nothing happened to her. Is that accurate?
It is correct that the initial investigation was regarding another alleged victim in which there had been a conviction in 2001. However, I don't believe it was solely related to that one incident of did something happen to you here only. I think it was a more of a broader discussion of, yes, that incident, but CR said nothing happened at all. Not just that the incident didn't happen in relation to her, that she wasn't touched in any way during that alleged incident, but mother's response in the report was no incidents have happened. So it creates a broader context that clearly the police felt enough to ask about it and investigate a little bit because there was another alleged victim with somewhat of a similar pattern. And this person was in the vicinity, CR.
Okay. So just to be clear, CR said that nothing happened with respect to the bathroom incident to her, correct?
CR said nothing happened to mother regarding the bathroom incident, but it, based on how the report reads, it's all incidents. Like there were no incidents. Nothing ever happened between her and appellant.
Okay. But so did you say mother told the police that nothing happened at all? There are no incidents whatsoever. Was that the mother who said that or CR?
Mother said CR told her. So mother is the one who directed it to the police. But, and there is no showing of whether or not the police further investigated or attempted to have an interview with CR. And that is likely based on mother's statement that CR told that her nothing has happened.
Okay. So the two incidents that form the 2019-2020 charges, those are separate incidents from the bathroom incident that was reported in 2001, correct?
Yes, that would be. They are in the same time frame.
They're in the same time frame, but did they occur? We know that CR testified that one of them may have occurred the same day as the bathroom incident, but she doesn't know for sure when that occurred, though, correct?
Yes. And that's, again, one of the issues we run into here and why we have these statute of limitations in place is because we've had such a delay in charging. CR cannot remember enough detail to determine whether or not there, when the actual incident occurs. She has a vague memory or understanding based on what she's claiming that there were these incidents, but there's no evidence to really support it, but her testimony. Well,
the evidence is her testimony, and that alone yes. can be enough. What about the second incident? Do we know, did that occur before or after the bathroom incident? Do we know that from the record?
My understanding is CR didn't identify an exact date, if it was before or after the bathroom. It seemed that they were around the same time, but I couldn't say that it was after or before.
Okay, thank you. That was my recollection of the record, but I just wanted to confirm that. But so in 2001, then the police did not have any information or knowledge of any other incidents. And those, the two incidents that were charged only came to light after CR thought about it and you know, 20 years later, remembered those incidents.
I agree that that's what CR states. However, I disagree that the police had no knowledge of incidents. Again, this goes to the notice. There isn't.
Well, how could they know? How could the police know about the two later charged incidents when she never told anybody? She didn't recall them at the time. She didn't recall them until much later after talking to the investigator, and then after initial discussion, went back to the investigator and said, wait a minute, there actually were a couple more incidents. Here's what else happened.
Again, I think this goes to the issue of notice. I don't think that it's whether or not she remembered the incidents and when she remembered them. It's when the police were made aware of maybe allegations were to occur. And that's when investigations would take place.
But maybe allegations were to occur. How are the police to know when they're told by Sierra's mother there weren't any incidents at all, any other incidents at all?
That's a call that the police department can make. If they are not sure and they don't know if Sierra's mother accurate, they had the opportunity and ability to interview CR if they chose, and if CR's mother allowed. There didn't seem to be any indication that CR's mother was trying to interfere with the police in interviewing CR. The police felt, based on what they did, that there was not enough there to pursue any further issues. And the reason why this is important is because, again, they were investigating a similar incident with another victim, and they felt, based on their own report, that nothing happened or nothing needed further investigation. That was the notice, though, for the police, that if they thought something was there, they could have investigated. And the fact that we now have more, almost 20 years later, trying to investigate a crime from 2001 when there is no evidence or ability to get any other evidence besides CR's testimony, where she herself can't remember enough detail to explain anything based on the age. And I don't dispute or disagree that that's the issue here, is because of how old this case is, we are missing significant amounts of evidence that would have been probably presented in a normal trial in these types of cases. And so that
if we can put aside that, because I think there's still issues there in terms of what evidence could be produced, because there wasn't any physical evidence that this is really comes down to more or less a he said, she said. But and he actually, well, let's leave it at that. I have a broader question, and that is, isn't this issue forfeited? Because this wasn't raised to the district court, so the district court didn't decide this issue, didn't consider this issue. And on appeal, we generally don't consider issues that haven't been raised to and decided by the district court.
I respectfully disagree that it's been forfeited. And you're right. Generally, we don't bring we are not allowed to bring forward these issues.
Well, but the 2001 incident, that argument, that was not raised to the district court, although it was a 2008 polygraph information that was raised before the district court.
At the contested omnibus hearing, that was the only information, from my understanding, that the counsel, the original counsel, had. They did not have the 2001 report yet. That would have been afterwards. Then there was a stipulated fact trial because they wanted the presentation specifically up to the Court of Appeals. I do not believe that, therefore, it forfeits the right, because the issue before the court was whether or not there was a statute of limitations problem based on the notice of when the police received it. It was, the theory was that 2008 polygraph. However, if there is record and evidence that the notice was in 2001, it doesn't become forfeited because a stipulated fact trial brought it up to the Court of Appeals. Again, generally.
Can I just ask a quick question then? So it seems to me, are you asking us to decide this for the first time, to go back and look at the record that was developed then? Or should you be saying, look, you should send it back to the district court? I mean, this is as you acknowledge, not the sort of thing we usually decide, you know, here at the Court of Appeals in the first instance.
I see I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Please do.
Thank you. I think it's an ability for the Court of Appeals either to address it on their own, because it is a de novo review. So as a matter of law, looking on the record independently, would this be considered notice? However, the court also has the ability to say, because of these procedural issues and concerns, that it should be remanded down to the district court to reevaluate and see if it would happen. This isn't an instance where we had a jury trial. It was stipulated specifically on this pretrial issue and brought forward, and this new evidence was there. We would ask for either option, Your Honors. We would be either requesting that this be reversed because on its own independent review, there was no finding, or if the court felt that this should have been looked at by the district court and could still be looked at by the district court, therefore it should be presented back down and remanded. And that, again, goes towards my ineffective assistance of counsel, which I'll address during rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, we will turn to you next. The timer will be reset, and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, and good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Jill Jensen, and I represent the state of Minnesota. I want to start kind of where we left off with Ms. Olson's argument, which is the state contends that this argument was absolutely forfeited. These facts were not before the district court for consideration. It was solely a statute of limitations argument based on a 2008 polygraph. I think the only context in which this court could consider the new allegation about the 2001 report would be in the context of, was counsel ineffective in not making this argument? This kind of goes both toward the district court not having the opportunity to review all the evidence related to this this argument. However, this case was brought, it was the third of three cases that were brought against Mr. Konikowicz beginning in 2019. This case was charged in May of 2020, And the 2001 evidence, or the police reports from the 2001 evidence, was actually disclosed in both of the other two underlying files back in April of 2020, so before this case was even charged. Nonetheless, I'd like to point out, based upon counsel's argument, that the police reports regarding the interviews of the underlying victim, her mother, and a witness in this case are littered with references to the 2001 investigation regarding Mr. Konikowicz's prior conviction for a different child. Those reports make very clear that the only incident that was even reported to law enforcement was that Mr. Konikowicz was giving the victim in that case and the victim in this case a bath, and had stuck a knife in the door in order to prevent entry. Judge Jessen had asked Ms. Olson what level of detail was required in order to put the police on notice that something may have happened. And I think State v. Swan, which I cite in my brief, is very instructive on this issue. In that case, there was sexually inappropriate conduct that was alleged. In this case, there's even less. It's merely that while babysitting these two children, he gave them a bath. Now, in retrospect, we know there was a whole slew of victims who delayed disclosure in coming forward. But State v. Swan says it has to be particularized. It has to be the, quote, particular offense. And here, what we have is a bath. We don't have digital penetration. We don't have fondling. None of that stuff was disclosed. And so based on everything in the reports that were received at the stipulated evidence trial, it's very clear from the record that even if counsel was ineffective in not bringing this claim, which I dispute that they did, that the appellant has met its burden to overturn the strong presumption that counsel was effective in this case, the result of the proceeding would not have been different. And that's that. I hope you guys are following me with somewhat of a convoluted argument, but I think that's the only way that this 2001 evidence can and should be considered by this court is would the result of the proceeding have been different if counsel had made this argument? And I think the answer is no, based upon the evidence that this court has seen throughout the reports. It's very clear throughout the victim's reports to Investigator Reed that she never reported until November 2019 when she posted on Facebook stating, "This happened to me too." And
Ms. Jensen, as we're talking about the ineffective assistance of counsel, could you just help me with just a procedural aspect? Often in these cases where we have kind of ineffective counsel brought as part of a direct appeal, you know, we'll get a motion to stay and, you know, let them develop the record and post-conviction proceedings, you know, and then we consolidate that, right? You know, and that way, at least there's an opportunity for a hearing on these ineffective assistance of counsel claims, you know, which sometimes is very helpful, you know, and but we don't have that here. I mean, should we have the ability to send it back for that? Or did we miss the opportunity? Does that just really limit the record before us? Would appreciate your perspective on that and perhaps in rebuttal yours as well, Ms. Olson.
The court, I from what I reviewed, it typically considers it as part of a post-conviction proceeding. However, it can consider it as part of a direct appeal if there's enough information in the record. I think there is enough information in the record for this court to consider it. But I don't believe the court needs to send this back for an evidentiary hearing or a post-conviction hearing on that matter, because they're the only arguments that have been made are one, a mere argument of assertion that they failed to fully investigate it. And two, there is enough information in the record for this court to dispose of this claim in this direct appeal. So I don't think that's necessary.
Ms. Jensen, I have a follow-up question along those lines, and it's kind of similar to Judge Jessen's procedural. So you argue that the statute of limitations argument based on the 2001 report is forfeited.
Yes.
And because it wasn't brought because of the procedural rule 27 stipulation trial, that particular issue wasn't raised. It was only the 2008. So you argue on appeal that that issue is forfeited, and so we don't even need to address it. But for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which is usually brought by post-conviction petition with a hearing, you now are arguing we can consider that even though it is based on the 2001 report. I'm just trying to figure out
what, absolutely,
what are you requesting here? I mean, how should we, if you had your way, how would we address this?
If I had my way, I think preliminarily the court could dismiss of the 2001 claim as forfeited, and it doesn't need to consider both prongs of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, because if you don't have both, then counsel is not ineffective. I've made many alternative arguments in my brief, but I don't think there's a showing that counsel was ineffective or that they've overcome the strong presumption that counsel was ineffective, such that you would even need to consider whether if they had brought this motion, the result would have been different, because matters of trial strategy, what arguments to make, are generally left up to trial counsel. However, if alternatively, if the court would consider that prong or has felt that they overcome the burden and made that argument, that is the context in which I would argue that the court consider whether this 2001 evidence would have made the result of the proceeding different, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, and you know, you did argue in the alternative, which is fine. I mean, you can certainly do that, but you know, what do you think is your strongest argument is maybe maybe a better question.
I think they're equally strong, but I think the court can look at the 2001 evidence for the purposes of completely disposing with this charges with this claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, purely because State v. Swan is so instructive and so close to the facts in this case. In that case, the police interviewed the victim about the sexually inappropriate nature of it. They ultimately decided that because her relatives had said nothing happened, they decided not to pursue it. And there's, and then it happened again. And then finally she came forward with a different penetration. And so my supposition would be that trial counsel probably was aware of that case and chose not to bring that as a matter of trial strategy. But I think they're both equally strong. And I guess that's not really taking a position, but that would be what I think the strongest argument is the 2001 issue is forfeited. The 2008 issue, I think, is also waived because there was no argument whatsoever made in the brief. The ineffective assistance of counsel claim can be disposed on the first prong because they have not met their burden to overcome that strong presumption. However, there's enough information in the record to dispose of their claim that the 2001 that the 2001 record was a report to police, such that that entire claim can be disposed of. I think the only remaining claim would be whether the state delayed charging or investigating this matter. And I think it's fairly clear from the record that upon receiving the claim in November 2019, police immediately began investigating it. They actually, to clarify a point, had received as your honors know, a CHIPS maltreatment report, a report of the polygraph note in 2020, and are required to cross-report to police. So that was the only information they received in January of 2020, was that a polygraph report existed. To another point, I would also point out that the appellant can't, I don't believe the appellant can establish any substantial prejudice or a delay, an intentional delay by the state to obtain a tactical advantage. appellant counsel has referenced potential physical evidence, but it's very unlikely that any exculpatory evidence exists based upon appellant's own admissions in that 2008 polygraph, or what he's argued is that the child he named in that report is the same as this victim. And so there likely would not be any evidence that exists. But nonetheless, I would point out that many of the evidence was preserved, such as the mother, the mother of the 2001 victim who had the victim in her apartment when appellant perpetrated the abuse. And so there were still witnesses that were available and remembered particularized detail. And so for those reasons, unless this court has any other questions, I'd rely on my brief and request that this court affirm the district court's order and conviction.
I'm not seeing any other questions from the panel, so thank you for your argument, counsel. We will turn to counsel for appellant for the rebuttal. There are 5 minutes on the clock. Please begin when you are ready.
Thank you. Just as a procedural issue regarding the ineffective assistance of counsel, the original omnibus hearing did not relate to the 2001 report because the 2001 report had not been disclosed by the state, from my understanding. While the 2001 report may have been in two other cases, that evidence is not allowed to then be used in the third case, as it needs to still be presented and decided on. The fact that it was known to counsel in these two other cases, which they also represented and did not see or really investigate in any way into this 2001 report, is where the ineffective assistance of counsel lies. There is a neglect here that they should have proceeded with the defense. It was a defense that directly related to the statute of limitations argument, which they made. The other concerning issue is that appellant's counsel stipulated to submissions of a polygraph result and the statements within that polygraph result, which are inadmissible in a criminal trial. They cannot be used. And by not having that, there isn't this additional evidence that has been claimed by the state that they that this had been disclosed in 2008, that then all of a sudden memories got jogged. The clear issue is whether or not in 2001 the police had this showing. And I agree that the original reason for the investigation in 2001 was based on this incident with the bathtub and things of that nature. But the incidents based on CR's testimony were all around the same time frame, same area. It was not discussed. I disagree that State v. Swan is similar enough in its facts to be a posit in this case, mainly because in that case, the allegations happened after as well. There was an incident. The family member said, no, nothing happened. It happened again. And then there was further, there was an additional discussion and interview with the child itself. In this case, there was nothing that got brought forward. There's no actual evidence that the incidents that had been alleged here happened before or after the bath incident, which led to the original investigation. And there, as noted, there was a 2001 investigation related to a different victim with similar charges when the police were aware, also in 2001, of this bath incident.
Counsel?
Yes.
I know you didn't have a lot of time to talk about the ineffective assistance of counsel argument in your opening argument. Could you just explain why it wasn't a matter of trial strategy for the attorney to include the polygraph to try and demonstrate that information was provided that would have triggered that statute of limitations?
I think it's understood that the Department of Corrections is not a law enforcement arm in the nature of these statute of limitations. I know that is what was argued originally. However, what really makes the ineffective assistance of counsel is the failure to further investigate a defense that seems very clear could have been brought forward, especially with the claims that were being made on the statute of limitations. This 2001 report should have been addressed. Deputy Reed discusses the fact that there what he reviewed a CHIPS file, not a maltreatment report, not something like that, but the CHIPS file. And in the CHIPS file, it had it. It sounds like Deputy Reed must have been aware enough of the police reports, or if not the Deputy Reed, the prosecution, that it got disclosed in two other cases, that these actions had been investigated, or at least the police had been aware that something may have happened and they chose not to further investigate.
Can I just ask, is it, in, you keep referring to it's been disclosed in two other cases, is that in the record before us?
No, it's not. And the reason is we did not have an opportunity to have really post-conviction relief the way that it had been set up.
But wasn't that kind of a decision, you know, either you or your client, I mean, you know, made, and, you know, it's you're showing that's necessary as far as ineffective assistance of counsel. And if you didn't ask for that relief and ask for that hearing and develop that evidence and put that in the record.
I see I'm out of time. May I respond?
Please respond to Judge Jessen's question.
Thank you. It was not a matter of trial strategy to not have that hearing. It was a matter of necessity. When we were hired and when we attempted to get evidence from counsel, we were not able to do so. In fact, we had to motion the court to get the prosecutor to give me the entire evidence file because I received nothing from counsel. That occurred on November 17th, we had a hearing on it. The court agreed with me, and then I did not get evidence until actually after the notice of appeal must be filed, or my client would have lost his right to his statute of limitations argument. It put me in a situation where I either had to argue ineffective assistance of counsel at that time, which I believe is allowed under here, because again, you can have that hearing or the direct appeal or try to do this without evidence. In fact, I didn't get the evidence from prosecution until after my notice had been filed. And that is due to just timing. We couldn't get the motion hearing until right before it was due. I had to make a decision to best protect my client and his rights under both issues. And that leads again to the ineffective assistance of counsel, the fact that I couldn't even have the evidence to fully vet everything. And it was upon reviewing the case after receiving all the evidence that I saw there was a 2000 report and that was never mentioned at the stipulated fact trial. I don't think that is a mere trial strategy. That is a significant amount of evidence when you have a deputy who said the first time he had any knowledge of this, or the first time Brown County Sheriff's Office had knowledge of potential alleged incidents was in this cross-reference of 2019, when it's clear that there was a report in 2001 of maybe something was happening in that area.
Thank you, counsel. And thanks to both of you for your argument today and for the briefing. It was very helpful. The court will take this matter under